The Tom Woods Show, episode 679.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody, if you like audio content, and I know you do because you're listening to this podcast, remember you can get one of my audiobooks for free through the special offer at Audible. Check it out at tomwoodsaudio.com. Is email driving you crazy and taking over your life? Do you feel like you can never possibly get and stay caught up? Well, here's my secret weapon, sanebox.com/woods. That's sanebox.com/woods. Hello, everybody. Tom Woods here. Michael Malice triumphantly returns to the program today. We're going to talk about voting and our differing views on the subject. It may not be exactly what you think, but it's always fun when I talk to Michael Malice. Michael Malice is a celebrity ghostwriter. You can visit him at michaelmalice.com. You'll find him frequently on Kennedy on the Fox Business Network and on other programs on Fox Business and on Fox News. He is a columnist for The Observer, and his most recent collaboration, this time with comedian D.L. Hughley, I believe this is the second volume they've done together, a book called Black Man, White House, is doing extremely well on Amazon as I speak to you. So check out tomwoods.com/679 for all kinds of Michael Malice stuff, including a recent book he wrote under his own name called Dear Reader, the unauthorized autobiography of Kim Jong-il. Wonderful, wonderful book. So tomwoods.com/679 is where to go for links to all these wonderful things. You will want to get to know Michael Malice better. And let's see, one other thing. Make sure you stick around after my conversation with Michael. I have a couple of interesting items to tell you about, including an interesting roundtable episode I've got coming up for you next week. I'll be telling you who's going to be on that, and it'll be a lot of fun. Okay, Michael Malice, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, we're going to talk about voting today. I'm going to link to your Guardian piece on voting, of course.
Yeah.
That is at tomwoods.com/679. I've got it up on my computer. I read it when it came out. But I think, you know, there are a lot of different reasons somebody might favor abstention from voting. And you don't necessarily put forth all of those reasons. So some people might say, I've heard some libertarians say that voting is a form of aggression. And I don't think that's the tack you're taking here. So let me ask you, do you think voting in politics anyway is a form of aggression?
Absolutely not. And that's a really, I think, really stretching the nap, you know, in the same way that like freedom means like I have the freedom to get a minimum wage. The idea that if I go in a lever, I flick a switch, somehow that means people are entitled to use force against me. Because if it's aggression, you're violating the nap, right? So it's okay to go in and beat somebody up. That's absurd.
Right, right, right. And it's true that a politician who is elected has the capacity to inflict harm, but the capacity to inflict harm is not the same thing as aggression.
And that capacity doesn't come from the voter. It comes from nothing. There is no legitimacy for political authority, so that vote is completely irrelevant. It's just like kind of a shell game to give you a rationalization to use force, to give the politician a rationalization to use force. So your vote is irrelevant in terms of giving him the validity of his actions or disavowing them.
Right, right. And so, again, this is another area where you and I would agree on this subject. There are people who say that if you vote, you can't complain. And if you don't vote, you can't complain. And if you, like, whatever. There are all these reasons that no matter what course of action you follow, you can't complain. Well, doggone it, I'm going to complain. And secondly, Lysander Spooner is very sound on that, too. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm a New York Jew. I'm going to be complaining regardless of whatever the situation is. So please spare me. You're trying to tell me when I can and can't complain. I will find a reason and I will make a reason.
All right. So I've read your Guardian piece, but I understand, you know, these articles have word limits and everything, and it doesn't necessarily express your entire philosophy of voting. So I want to just clear some possible opinions you may hold out of the way if, in fact, you don't hold them. So are you saying – so we don't think that it's necessarily – or that it's aggression to vote. Are you saying then that it is wrong to vote or simply that it's stupid and pointless to vote?
I'm not saying either of those things. And let me make a more basic point. Ayn Rand once said with her typical understatement that Immanuel Kant was the most evil man who ever lived, which is a great trivia question. Like, who does Ayn Rand think is the most evil person who ever lived? It's not Stalin, it's not Hitler, it's Immanuel Kant.
Okay.
And one of the things I really, 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 really hate from Kant is what he calls the universability principle, meaning that one should act as if in a way that everyone on earth can act in that same way. And that's how you know something's moral, if it can be applied universally. And I think that's the complete opposite of the truth. So I would, you know, and you see this in offices sometimes, which, again, if someone says it with a straight face, they should be thrown out the window, where a boss will say, hey, I need you to come in and work on the weekend. I'm not asking you to do anything I wouldn't do. Well, I don't care about your weekend. I don't care about your time. Like, we have different lives. We have different schedules. We have different preferences. Go live your life. If you coming in the office is more important to you than your weekend, that's fine. That's no correlation on me. Same thing with voting. I don't vote. A good shorthand definition of libertarianism is keep the government out of the bedroom and the boardroom. Well, I don't tell people how to act in the ballot box either. Go in there, flick a switch, and do whatever you like. I'm going to live my life differently from you. And the point I would make is the idea that flicking a switch once a year, you know, in the ballot box is going to have any effect on anything. You know, you have to recognize on some level that it's a ritual that has no real meaning. However, if a ritual has symbolic meaning for you, you know, like for some religious holiday, you're putting up a Christmas tree, more power to you.
Okay, so this is a decision that you've made as an individual, but you're not saying that your behavior, in order to be justifiable, has to be universalizable, that we all have to accept your view on voting.
Correct. And this argument people have is like, what if everyone acted like you? Well, we got a ways to go before anyone's acting like Michael Malice, number one. Number two is, what kind of fantasy land Stalin is everyone supposed to be, where it's like, well, if I were Stalin and everyone acted like me, then things would be great. That's a nonsense, non sequitur argument. So I don't begrudge people the ability to vote or whatever they want to do. What I do begrudge them is this idea that somehow they're going to pass judgment on me because I'm not following their stupid little ritual.
Oh, okay, but now wait a minute. Now you're saying that it's a stupid little ritual. But what if I say, and this is how I felt all the way back in 2008. I thought, here's Ron Paul. I really admire him and I like him. And I think he's doing a lot of good saying the things he's saying. And he's in his 70s, and this, even though he's in excellent physical condition, this can't be easy on him. And I know he doesn't like being in hotels, and he doesn't sleep well in hotels, so he's haggard and exhausted, and he's out there trying to do this for us. I feel like sitting home and not doing this simple thing for him, as a, yes, he doesn't know that I did it, and I know that the fact that he got 1,100,817 votes isn't going to mean anything as compared to whether he got, you know, blah, 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 16 votes. I understand that. But out of deference to him and respect for him, doggone it, I'm going to get off my rear end and go vote. Now, why was that wrong?
Because if you look, that hour it spends you to go vote is an hour you could have worked. Work for that hour and give that money to his campaign. And that would have much more of an effect than the vote, wouldn't it? That's just economics.
Yeah.
Or do both. You know, if you want to pat yourself on the back and say, don't blame me, I voted for Ron Paul. That's
okay,
fine,
but
too. I'm not
on the other hand, no, I'm using time I've already decided to allocate for leisure to go cast my vote. And I've decided this is the best form of leisure time because I think to myself, all right, I actually get to do this as one little gesture for a guy who's done so much for me.
I'm certainly not going to begrudge people their leisure time. If you want to sit on TV and veg out and watch bad television, I do that a lot because when I write, writing to me is a very, very intense activity. So after I write, I need a break that's going to make my brain shut off. And the best way to do that is to watch bad television because it's as close to being in a coma as possible by being awake, right? Because there's absolutely no thought to it whatsoever. So if you think it's fun to go out and flick a switch for Ron Paul, maybe take a little Instagram photo of, you know, by the name, you know, more power to you. I'm not going to begrudge that. But the idea that it's a moral imperative is nonsense. And the idea, but more importantly, in the Guardian article I think I was getting at is the idea that politicians are going to act depending on how you vote, that is absolutely false.
Okay. But I think we can both – I'm talking about – I mean, in practice, I'm probably more or less with you because there's almost never a time when I feel compelled to vote for somebody. It was basically just Ron Paul.
Right.
And then before that, was before I really knew anything.
If you knew him, it's different too.
Yeah, and so that is somewhat different. But I just couldn't have lived with myself if I couldn't have at least done this one little thing for him after all he's done. I think I get what you're saying. And I understand the point that not everybody is going to act the way you act, and you're not even urging them to act the way you act. You're just explaining yourself. Fair enough. But at the same time, there are other people, in addition to Michael Malice, in the libertarian world who say voting's stupid and it's a waste of time. And I know these people, and these are good friends of mine, a lot of them. And I understand where they're coming from. But when a lot of them start saying this, that can affect a lot of people.
What kind of Marxist thinking is this?
It's not Marxist thinking that people are influenced by ideas. That's anti-Marxist thinking.
It's Marxist thinking that people shouldn't have leisure and shouldn't waste their time and they should be good workers all the time. If someone wants to be leisurely and waste their time, I am delighted that we live in a society that people have different types of leisure and different types of time wasters more than they can count. That's wonderful. You want to vote? You want to go to the pool? Read a book? Read a bad magazine? Take a nap? More power to you. And this idea that, like, oh, if a lot of people think this way, well, that's nice. I don't care what a lot of people think. I care what I think and what I'm going to do with my time, and I'm not going to begrudge them theirs. So this whole idea of the liberty movement, and I'm using movement with quotes, that somehow we're this, you know, a union in a kind of political sense, and we all have to have a hive mind, is absolutely contradictory to the very spirit of libertarianism.
Okay. Think about the way most people get their political ideas. It's now, and I'm talking about intelligent people. I'm talking about people who are engineers, people who are extremely knowledgeable in a lot of different areas. How do they get their political ideas? Do they sit down and read? Do they read John Rawls? Do they read Robert Nozick? The question answers itself. They get their ideas from the newspaper and from the people running for office. And they just naturally assume, because they're not specialists, that this must be more or less the spectrum of available opinion, so I'll try and position myself somewhere along there. But if libertarians are taking part in this in one way or another, if libertarians are part of the conversation, then it's more likely that somebody will say, oh, wait a minute, there are further options that I might entertain. That person won't think about those options if libertarians aren't in the game, and libertarians won't get in the game if they feel like libertarians don't vote anyway, so the whole thing is pointless. And now if you're going to come back at me and say, but I'm not necessarily saying that my point of view is universalizable, but you're advocating for that point of view in The Guardian, and other people are advocating for that point of view, so aren't you defeating the whole project by doing that?
You're playing devil's advocate very poorly. Like, leave the devil's advocating to me. You're a good Christian man. I am not. So let me explain something.
I am doing an awesome job, but go ahead.
Well, there's that satanic hubris. Listen, if you are going to – I agree libertarians should be part of the conversation, but the election is the consequence of the conversation. So if someone's, for example, a pollster and calls you up and you're a libertarian, I would say a 100% answer the poll – because that is – the conversation takes over like a year and a half of the presidency, for example, and then that one day is the consequence. So the idea that also that your voice is being heard when you're doing something secretly, you know, in a secret ballot box, that's nonsensical and false. And again, that Guardian article said why I won't vote this year or any year, but it specifically said I, and it said leave me alone. I said if someone wants to go to church, and you know, I just took a joke at you about religion, I think church is great. I think I know a lot of people who have found faith and they become better human beings as a result of it. More power to them. But I'm not going to go to church with them. I'm not going to have them, you know, do what I want. I think there's just many different paths to libertarianism. And I think the idea that the one day of the year where it's going to be almost impossible to have your political voice heard is on election day when everyone is posturing and, you know, proclaiming their virtue on Facebook by I voted, I voted, I voted. Every other day, you can talk politics and actually break through the conversation. And and also, you know, like saying, oh, libertarians don't vote. Well, I mean, it's like saying, well, libertarians don't tend to not to join the armed services either. I mean, that's not necessarily a bad message to put out there.
All right, let's think about actual examples in history of momentous things that happen. Let's think like now. I'm not. Believe me, I understand your point. Believe me, I understand your point. People can vote all they want. And yet somehow the same wars are declared, well, not even declared, of course, and the same, you know, I get that. But I do know that I can think of cases in history when I can't see how, other than through politics, the change could have occurred. So there was no way through voluntary direct action that you were going to shut down the Second Bank of the United States. Andrew Jackson did that, period. Andrew Jackson did that. Secondly, the corn laws in Britain. I mean, this was making food more expensive.
Can we handle Andrew Jackson?
Yeah, go ahead.
Andrew Jackson's a perfect example of what I'm talking about, because he lost the vote the first time around and the House voted for Quincy. So that's exactly my point, that your vote in America, your vote for presidency literally does not count. What counts is the Electoral College. The electors elect the president, as you know. And as you also know, in my view, the right to vote is illegal in America because the Constitution was not passed legally. This Constitutional Convention expressly did not have the right to throw out the Articles of Confederation. They did it surreptitiously and swore themselves to secrecy until Luther Martin broke out of there and said, hey, this is a coup. And that's exactly what ended up happening. And once the coup happened, then all the states ratified it and ex post facto justified this illegal action. So that's exactly how politics work. The politicians decide what they want to do. Then they find some legal rationale to justify what they wanted to do legally that has nothing to do with the so-called will of the people, number one. Number two, the idea of the will of the people is something we should be respecting is also crazy, because those who need leaders are not qualified to choose them. That's the central problem of democracy. You're asking an average person to have above average intelligence and knowledge, which is also impossible. So, you know, Andrew Jackson is a perfect example of this because he had the election stolen from him, and that proves exactly that votes don't matter.
I want to ask you, now, so think about your answer for a minute, because I know you always need to think for 5 or 10 minutes before the answers. I want you to answer for me, how does social change take place? And how can it take place? Is there a way it can take place in a libertarian direction that does not involve politics? And I'm going to ask you that after this message from our sponsor. Folks, if you're like me, you're buried in email and you're pleading for help. You don't know what to do about it. It's interfering with your mental health and your life and your peace of mind, and you don't know what to do about it. Well, the answer is SaneBox. I use it myself. I swear by it. It sorts my email. It makes sure that I see the important stuff and that I can see the unimportant stuff on my own time when I get around to it. I can tell it to resend me emails in a couple of days when I'm ready to deal with them, so that by the end of the day, I have one way or another dealt with all my email every single day. You need this for your mental health. You need it for your productivity. You need it for efficiency. So check it out at SaneBox. That's SaneBox, SaneBox.com/woods, and get a free trial. And then when you do what I did, which is when your free trial runs out, you immediately rush to throw money at them because you've got to have this service. You automatically get a $25 off credit as a Tom Woods Show listener. You've got to use that link, SaneBox.com/woods. All right. I kind of have a sinking feeling I know how you're going to answer this, but part of the problem I have with the don't vote people is this. Yes, I understand politics is terrible and it's terrible people and all that. I get that. But I don't see how things ever change. It's fun to say, oh, we'll do it without politics. Oh, really? How? Like, well, how are you going to confront this thing without actually confronting this thing? Well, we'll have agorism. What? You're gonna build heavy industry secretly? I just don't see that. So I don't understand if we're not in the game, or we're not encouraging people to be in the game, or we're actively and openly disdaining the idea of participating in, at least getting our ideas heard, we're missing an opportunity to be heard. But secondly, how can things ever change? What is the model of social change that does not involve politics?
Well, there's a couple of points I'd make. First of all, I think you're kind of being silly when you say just because we vote doesn't mean we're not getting our voice heard, because obviously you and I are in a podcast right now and our voices are being heard, perfectly well. But there's two points I'd make. First of all, as Breitbart said, politics is downstream of culture. You know, Hillary Clinton did not have a big change of heart on gay marriage. What happened is the country's, views on gay marriage, and Obama also somehow had this epiphany that he's for gay marriage, really. The country's ideology shifts and the politicians act accordingly later. So the first and most important thing is to change the culture. This is a reason why Alice Shrugged is so important, because when you come in with these set of preconceived notions like disdain for the state and, you know, veneration for, you know, the industrialists, the creative industrialists, that really affects politics in a preemptive way. That's number one. The other big example is, you know, I want to destroy the game board. And the way to do that isn't necessarily through democratic processes, because I don't care what the vast majority of people do. We have to make an asymmetry where they don't have the ability to put their stupid ideas into practice. For example, I don't begrudge anyone a religion unless it's a state religion, right? That's when it becomes difficult, when the government and religion are intertwined, and then that church has the ability to force its will on people. That's when things get very, very ugly. The thing that has worked is this, and I've used this example in another podcast. Let's suppose it's 1970, right? So we're clearly in a technologically advanced time. We've walked on the moon. You can't say man's primitive. And you have an argument about censorship. And on the one hand, someone says, well, we should have complete free speech and not ban any books. And the other guy goes, well, what about Mein Kampf? What about, you know, photography books about child pornography? And they can argue all day long. And I appear from 2016 and I tell you this argument is pointless, because in 40 years, I will be able to take any book, and with the press of one button, I will be able to duplicate this book. And with the press of one button, I will be able to send it anywhere on Earth at the speed of light. And I can make it such that the only person who has a secret word, a password, can open this book, and I can do this infinitely. Oh, and all of this is free. I would be looked at like a maniac. And yet that's exactly the case right now with any kind of document. So it all comes down to technology and having a asymmetry between people who want to impose their will on you and binding their hands so that they can't. It's not going to be up to persuasion, because there will always be human beings who are going to want to have an excuse to control your life, and there's no real point in arguing with them. You just have to bind their hands.
Now, that's really nice sounding and everything, because all that stuff is true, and we are living through revolutionary times. But I still see a Supreme Court that could at any moment make all – especially under Hillary Clinton – could begin making all kinds of bizarre and authoritarian demands of all kinds of neighborhoods across the country. And it doesn't matter how many encrypted books I can send all around the world. That's going to do a lot of damage to people's liberty. So what other than getting – I mean, what is the anarchist way of dealing with the Supreme Court? I mean, you know, if we're not in the conversation as part – if people don't have an option to choose somebody like us, at least know that it's there – I don't see how that's a net plus for us.
Well, okay, but do you see with my censorship example that we did not have to be part of that conversation, that the conversation has become superfluous and irrelevant?
When we get to a point that it's technologically possible to make the Supreme Court irrelevant, I will concede that I've been wrong all this time.
No, just on that one specific point, you see what I'm saying about how there's really no – you're just wasting your breath to argue censorship now that we live in a time books can't be censored, right?
Of course. Yes, I do.
So there will come a time – it might be 100 years, it might be sooner, where, again, this is going to sound crazy, but imagine you're in 1970 and I said to you all those things. 1970 is not that long ago. If I said to you, hey, we're going to be able as a human being to just either teleport anywhere on Earth or move quickly enough, or instead of me being of citizenship being defined as a function of geography, because to be a function of the individual, citizenship and nationality is landline technology in a cell phone world. Remember, Tom, if I wanted to call you, you'd better be at your house or I can't reach you. Now it doesn't matter where you are, I can call you. It's going to come a time where citizenship is going to be a function of where that person happens to be and who he happens to want to be a citizen of, as opposed to, well, you're stuck between the Atlantic and Pacific, therefore you're beholden to Washington. So I think, yes, libertarianism is great in terms of holding the line, but I think very quickly the Supreme Court is going to have a lot of problems implementing a lot of their edicts. And again, if you think voting is going to make a difference in the Supreme Court, you think Hillary and Trump are going to be some kind of, you know, great bulwarks for liberty. I don't see that being the case.
No, I don't either. But I do think that based on the fact that Trump and – I mean, look, the Republicans have – it's true. They've appointed some rotten Supreme Court justices. No question about that. But from my point of view, these justices are vastly better than anybody the Democrats have ever – installed, and And I'm somebody who's constantly telling people the two parties have so many similarities. But on this, I think it is a genuine difference. There's no way the Democrats would go to the Federalist Society and ask for judicial names.
Sure.
And whereas Trump did. That's the first place he went, was he went and talked to the Federalist Society, and they gave him a list, and he went with that. So that's better. That's definitely an improvement. But all right, how about at the local level?
Can I make a point?
Yeah, please do. Yeah, you make all the points you like.
I am delighted to hear that I've converted you to a Hamiltonian Federalist Constitutionalist. This is wonderful to hear, and you heard it here.
That is absolutely false. I don't know where you got that from. Go ahead and explain yourself.
Everyone just heard
give me your cockamamie explanation as to why I'm a Hamiltonian. Go ahead.
You just said it. You just said you want Federalist. You want, like, the Federalist Society? You like constitutionalist judges? That's the Hamiltonian vision, isn't it?
Well, no. The Hamiltonian vision is what we live with now, with anti-constitutionalist judges. I would like the Constitution that Hamilton fought tooth and nail and misled everybody about during the Federalist Papers. How am I getting into this? We're not talking about this. I want to talk about at the local level. Can't you admit – okay, at the local level, they're having a bond issue. Should we float a bond for the schools, or should we raise taxes for the schools? You're not going to go and vote to say, no, don't raise my taxes? You're not even going to vote there?
Tom, I might vote, but I've never heard of any of these local issues even reaching my desk. I'm not aware of any of this. It might be a very different situation when you're living in New York, and I imagine it is, when you have the population density as high as it is here.
Okay.
If you're living in, you know, Kansas, God forbid, it might be very different, because then it might be some kind of local direct democracy populist kind of situation going on where you could have some town hall.
Yeah, there was – yeah, back years and years ago, back around 1990 in Massachusetts, there was something called Proposition 2.5. And basically the idea was that it would cap – it was either going to cap the growth of taxes or the tax rate or something on property taxes. It was something like that. And all the people for the schools were telling you not to vote for it, but everybody voted for it. And that's a case where it's a direct opportunity. Do I cast my vote for fleece me less or fleece me more? I think I'm going to go vote for fleece me less. And for people who say, oh, but you're validating the system. I am not validating the system. And I know that you're not saying that either, but I've got to hit that because people will say it. I always give the example of the slave labor camp. I'm not validating the slave labor camp if they give me a vote on whether or not I want to be released. I mean, what kind of an idiot is going to stay in a slave labor camp on principle because he doesn't vote, you know? Get me out of here. Well, on a much smaller scale, I'm in a slave labor camp now, and I want to improve my material condition. I'm not trying to validate anything. I just want to make myself better off. But at the local level, I can get there are state legislators in some states that are willing to try nullifying federal edicts. And I can either support those people by trying to get them elected, or I can say, oh, that doesn't really matter. Let's just all lie down like sheep. Why wouldn't I want to support those people?
You're playing a shell game, because the first example you use where you have a direct yes or no vote in a certain issue is really wonderful, because that's how a lot of like marijuana legalization and certain other things, these are issues that politicians are scared to touch because they're cowards and they don't want their necks in line. Or like Brexit, like the British leaving the EU is a great example, where the politicians are going to have clean hands and leave it up to the voters. That's a wonderful example of, yes, I could totally see why someone go out and vote and agitate for a certain issue, because this is really a binary one side good, one side bad situation.
Right.
However, that is not the same as saying I endorse this politician, because that is very different. Because saying this guy is going to nullify a lot of stuff, which might be great, you're getting a package deal. If I want someone to represent me, I will hire them. I will get a lawyer. I will get an accountant. I will get some other legal agent of myself. It is, in my view, kind of immoral to say this person is going to speak for me in terms of abortion and taxation and education and foreign policy, because then it kind of becomes this Nuremberg just following orders. You've ceded your moral authority to another human being, and I don't find that acceptable, reasonable, or conscionable.
All right. I get that it's a package deal. And I get that it's easier to justify voting against taxes in just a simple yes or no, do you want your taxes raised? Obviously, even I can justify voting for that better than I can justify voting for state senator blah, 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 because maybe state senator blah, blah, blah does and even if he says he's going to do wonderful things in addition to nullification, he could get in and do the opposite, because that's not exactly unheard of. So that is true. But you know, when you're dealing with something like this, sometimes you just have to roll the dice. And maybe I'm just a bigger risk taker than you are, and I want to roll the dice.
First of all, I think it's really true. It's really clear that I'm actually a more bigger risk taker than you. That, I mean, you're a family man, and I'm, you know, a kind of freak in New York. But it's a risk regardless. Do you know what I mean? The gun is put to your head, and you're playing Russian roulette. So the idea that, you know, if you roll those right numbers on the dice, you're not going to get the bullet is kind of a non sequitur. And I think it's an abnegation of morality to be like, this person is going to speak for me. And it doesn't make any sense to me on any level, because then you really
But you have no other option. In the way the system is set up, you have no other option. Somebody's going to pretend to be speaking for you.
Correct. So why am I going to go and validate the fact that this person has a legal claim or a moral claim to speak for me?
But you don't have to say that. You say, look, I want him to go do this. If he does this, great.
No. If you're voting, you're saying, I endorse this person to speak for me.
You're telling me what I'm saying?
I'm telling you what your action is saying. When you vote, you are saying, this person speaks for me on every political issue. That's what a vote means. It means you're endorsing this person to be your agent in the realm of politics. And that is absolutely nuts.
Well, I live my own life. If I choose somebody to be the president of the chess club, and he decides to close the club at 7 p.m. and I wanted it to stay open until 9, you know, that it's not a reflection on me. I chose him because he was the best guy. You know, and anybody, you have to be a lunatic to think, well, Woods is responsible for every single thing this guy does. Most of us know we're voting as a self-defense mechanism, thinking which person is going to be on net the least bad.
No.
And I don't think no. I'm responsible for anything, or I should, you know, or he's speaking for me. This is creepy. That's not why I'm voting.
That's why most people vote. I do not think most people vote from self-defense. I think most people vote because this is the candidate who kind of represents me and my views. People weren't voting for Obama out of self-defense.
No, that's true. I'm thinking about people that I give a darn about.
Yeah, so that 0.0001 whatever that you're friends with are not representative of the general population, which is the problem. Everyone we know is a rounding error.
I get that, and I know, you know, I'm realistic about the situation. But still, I've been advocating that people at the state level try and throw a monkey wrench into the works, and it just seems odd that I would then turn around and say, but anybody who says he's going to do this, don't vote for that person, because you never know what they might wind up doing. To the contrary, I want to say, look, these are courageous people who don't just want to be a cog in the machine. And yeah, I would vote for people like that, especially at the local level, where the damage they can do is more limited than what they could do at the federal level. I would certainly not have any problem voting there, but you still would.
Well, I mean, again, I think this is the difference between where you live and where I live, because at the local level, you know, as you know, Murray Rothbard tried to organize the local level here in New York. And it was kind of, you know, I read it in Justin Raimondo's biography of Murray, and it was kind of this joke. You know, he signed up for some third party that had, I don't even remember, they had ballot access, and he wrote their constitution for them, or their, you know, whatever, their bill of principles. And it was fun, and I can see him having a good time with it. But at the end of the day, it was completely irrelevant. So if that's something that people want to do and you know, be a troll on the local level, more power to you. But I think there's plenty of trolling to be had on the national level. And the way to do that isn't through voting. It's through, you know, so-called direct action. I don't mean assassination by direct action. I mean things like mocking politicians and so on and so forth. General mischief.
I still feel like there'll be people listening who will feel frustrated. They'll say, the other side does not hesitate to use politics and hurt us with it. So if our people just say, well, let's just forget about it and not participate, this is going to hurt.
Stop. I don't care about our people. If our people can do, there's no such thing as our people. There are people who agree with me on a lot of issues and they can do what they want. And there are people who disagree with me on a lot of issues and they can do what they want. This idea, again, you're speaking like a Kantian. This idea that just because people agree with me on terms of anarchism or in terms of, you know, liking Ayn Rand or collecting succulent plants, that somehow we all have to have a hive mind is just absolutely abhorrent and reprehensible to me. I don't begrudge them the right to vote, but I'm going to tell them it's a waste of time, and that's perfectly fine. They have a right to waste their time. If you really want to change politics, as obviously you do, Tom, because you spend a lot of time working on it, I mean, compare your podcast and your books to that one day a year you go and vote. I mean, which is going to have the more dramatic effect in terms of our American political culture? Come on.
So, all right. Well, I think you've kind of almost answered the question I was going to wrap up with, but I was just asked about by Isaac Morehouse in an episode of his podcast that's going to air on Monday about, you know, how it's easy to get discouraged about the state of the world and, you know, statism and all that. But what can you as an individual do other than just be discouraged about the world, which is, I think, how people would feel if they couldn't have that. You know, they think about it, participating in politics is the way I'm going to fight back. But suppose you were trying to tell them there are other things you can do in your life other than that. What would you say?
If you're discouraged about the world, you really need a reality check because things are getting better all the time in every single way. The fact that we can have this podcast is a perfect example of that. And the idea that you can't spend yourself rich and you can't vote yourself free.
Wow, that's an ending. That right there is an ending.
And if you quote me on that line, you better give me credit.
Yeah, I will.
And that's the audience, too. It's one of my great lines.
Now, listen, do you want to say something about the book that just came out?
Oh, yes. So you have.
Okay, go ahead.
So I co-authored a new book with the comedian D.L. Hughley, and it's called Black Man, White House, An Oral History of the Obama Years. And the N-word appears in the first line.
Yeah, that's right. I remember you told me about this many months ago, and I got the joke. I was really happy about it. I figured out what was supposed to be the joke in the line, but I'm sure it's. I haven't seen it, but if you had a hand in it, I'm sure it's great.
Oh, and speaking of changing politics, that book does a masterful job of completely destroying and discrediting the Republican Party, and I'm very proud of it for that.
Ah, okay, all right. Well, so half the job is done.
Exactly.
All right, very good. Michael Malice can be visited, of course, at michaelmalice.com. And I don't know, maybe we should do an episode on Things Are Getting Better.
Yeah, Camille would be great for that too. Camille Foster, yeah.
Oh, okay. All right, I'm making a note here. And that reminds me, by the way, I should say before we leave, just another word of thanks to that wonderful young woman who brought us together. And it was possible for me to meet you. I'm really grateful for that. So, all right. Great talking to you, Michael. This is an inside joke, everybody. It's an inside joke, but it's a good one. All right. I'll see you next time.
Bye, Tom.
All right. Two things I want to tell you about. Remember tomwoods.com/679. I will link to Michael's column on the subject of voting. So we'll get that out there. So check that out. But a couple things I want to tell you about. First is I am going to do sometime next week. So those of you who are not listening as the shows come out, let's say it'll just be a few episodes from now. Maybe it might be, let's say, somewhere around episode 683, something like that. I'm going to be doing a roundtable discussion on the Libertarian Party, its present and future, which of course will include some discussion of the Johnson-Weld ticket. And I'm going to have people of differing perspectives alongside me. We're going to have a really good discussion, I think. And those people will be Mary Ruart, who is a former Libertarian Party presidential candidate herself, Jeff Deist of the Mises Institute, Tom Mullen, who's been a guest on the show from tommullen.net, and Jason Rink of the Foundation for a Free Society. So it's people of different opinions on the state of the Libertarian Party and the Johnson-Weld ticket. So I think that will be a productive conversation because I know that my own listeners have a variety of views on this subject. So we're going to try and hash it all out among people who share a mutual respect. So that will be good. Second thing I want to tell you about is my mother's website. You know how I will promote people's websites if they use my link and so on, and I give them special goodies. Check that out at tomwoods.com/publicity if you're thinking of starting up a website or a blog. You get all kinds of goodies from me. So tomwoods.com/publicity tells you how to get those goodies. You got to check that out before you start up your site. Well, anyway, my own mother, it turns out, did exactly that. She used my link. So therefore, I wouldn't say therefore and for no other reason, but therefore she is certainly entitled to a mention here on the show. Let me tell you about my mother's website. It's called GameRoomHeaven.com. And at GameRoomHeaven.com, she talks about all kinds of things relating to creating a great game room. So she has a post, The Naked Game Room, 12 Great Tips to Create Your Space. There's a special emphasis right now on gaming chairs. I did not know there was such a thing as gaming chairs, but these gaming chairs have all kinds of features that make them an unbelievably great gift for people. And a gift for yourself if this is your sort of thing. You won't believe the sorts of things that are built into some of these gaming chairs. But anyway, all the posts on the site are written in kind of like my style. Like it's upbeat and funny and interesting, if I may say so. And you get a lot of information about all these different things. So it's a fun site to check out. And she's adding content to it all the time. She's going to be adding a whole range of different sorts of things that people like to put in game rooms. But for now, she's got these posts on these various topics that I think you'll find interesting. And you'll definitely want to bookmark it for the future to check back again as more content is added, because it really is a great game room site. It's called, once again, GameRoomHeaven.com. And I will be linking to it at TomWoods.com/679 as the listener website mentioned. Again, if you would like your website to be mentioned, check out the deal that I'm making to you at TomWoods.com/679. All right, that's going to do it for this week. But next week, we got fun, interesting stuff coming up. We're going to talk about anti-discrimination law. We're going to talk about the history of minority advancement in American history. Very, very, very good stuff. That roundtable on the LP is going to be great. And then coming up in a couple of weeks, the long-awaited and much-anticipated debate on free trade between Bob Murphy and Vox Day. So much great stuff coming up. I hope you'll stick around, and thanks so much for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.